Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your week in review for May 9th. So it looks like we've bottomed. Now what? Before we get to the bank stress test, let's take a look at the global economy. With each passing day, there are further signs the economy has bottomed. For each negative reading, such as Taiwan's exports for April falling 34% from year-ago levels, you have manufacturing indices in China and India over the 50 level, connoting growth in April. In the case of these last two, 9 and 8 month highs, respectively. On the other hand, China's vice premier said the global financial crisis is still spreading and the economy will get worse before it gets better, and that it was imperative countries work closely together to coordinate macroeconomic policies. But in an interview with the Financial Times, he hastened to add that China's huge stimulus package has now produced initial results, and there has occurred positive change. China's central bank is now saying the economy's performance was better than expected in the first quarter, and that it has spent only one-third of the stimulus money earmarked for the first year of a two-year plan. That's encouraging. Australia's unemployment rate for April came in far better than expected, 5.4%, as March retail sales there rose 2.2%. But the European Union forecast GDP will now decline 4% this year versus a January estimate for a fall of 1.8%. Ireland is leading the way with a projected plunge in GDP in 2009 of a staggering 9%. But at the same time, consumer confidence is ticking up in Spain, despite a 17.4% unemployment rate there. Cisco Systems reported that revenue for its quarter dropped to $8.16 billion from a year earlier level of $9.79 billion, but CEO John Chambers said his company's customers are seeing some stabilization, a significant comment from the normally conservative Chambers. Chairman Rupert Murdoch of News Corp said there are emerging signs in some of our businesses that the days of precipitous declines are done and that revenues are beginning to look healthier. Further signs we've hit bottom, and pending home sales in the U.S. actually rose along with construction spending. But in congressional testimony, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke voiced concerns over a relapse as business investment has remained extremely weak. And he expected that the recovery would be slower than usual, though he also conceded housing has, quote, shown signs of bottoming. The Fed's Janet Yellen spoke of the economy reaching, quote, an inflection point. I see a lot of downside risk, but at least there is some basis for optimism. Yellen adds, however, that once it takes hold, the recovery will be frustratingly tepid. Then we had Friday's jobs report for April. The unemployment rate hit 8.9%, but job losses came in at 539,000. Still dreadful, but a distinct improvement from a revised figure from March of 699,000. Does the fact we're bottoming warrant the spectacular rally we've seen in equities? Yes, but only if we soon begin to see good news, not just less bad, that will then translate into improving top-line revenue numbers and rising earnings. Were the global economy to just stall out over the next 3 to 6 months with no real progress, and I keep harping on the global view because one must never forget the multinational nature of much of corporate America, then stocks will suffer, though regardless the closing low of 676 on the S&P 500 is in. One other point, we have officially entered an era where budget deficits matter. For so long, people harped on the deficits, including yours truly, but in terms of funding them and any negative impact on the markets, it hasn't been an issue, thanks in no small part to China's economic engine that was churning out double-digit growth and gobs of yuan looking for a home. But as I wrote last week, the International Monetary Fund said the group of 20 leading economies would continue to run budget deficits of at least 6.5% next year compared with a similar figure for 2009. I wrote last week that that, my friends, translates into a ton of bonds that need to find a home, the paper being needed to finance said deficits. It also means higher yields, which in turn pushes up funding costs, which means more debt and so on. Yes, as rates have begun to rise in the U.S., this becomes a real concern in terms of the strength of any recovery. It's not a huge problem if mortgage rates move from 4.75% to 5.5%, for example. still historically very low, but you get to 6% and higher and we'll be in trouble. One of the issues for the coming months as investors around the world try to sop up each other's paper is, do governments such as our own, committed to quantitative easing through the buying of sovereign debt, have the firepower to keep rates in check? And will inflation stay in check? For now, let's just say I remain sanguine on inflation as long as wage pressures are non-existent, which should be the case for a long time to come. The current spike in commodity prices doesn't concern me in the least in terms of the big picture. Now to the banks and the stress test. Thanks to quantitative leaking, we knew all the results ahead of time, which, while it worked out in the end in terms of market behavior, is nonetheless more than a bit unsettling. I believe the parameters of the stress test were fair. An adverse scenario of a 3.3% contraction in the economy this year and 10.3% unemployment in 2010, for example, and in one instance way too tough, that being another 20% decline in real estate prices. As I said last week, if you believe, as I do, that the worst is over in the economy, the stress test is largely irrelevant, though a necessary evil. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, in finding that 10 of the 19 tested needed to raise more capital, $75 billion worth, said, quote, "Americans should know that the government stands behind the banking system and that their deposits are safe. But the government wants the likes of Bank of America and Wells Fargo to raise more capital so they will have the financial strength to increase lending, and they aren't about to do so until the economy improves, so you have a chicken and egg situation." Just roll this topic into the 3 to 6 month time category, along with everything else, as we wait for actual good news versus less bad. The good news on Friday was that Morgan Stanley and Wells Fargo raised $15 billion already of the $75 billion, which bodes well for the others. Turning to President Obama and the hedge funds, opposition to the government's restructuring plan for Chrysler collapsed on Friday as five firms gave up the fight, but the debate that initially ensued is an important one. George Will, The Washington Post. "It is demagoguery 101 to identify an unpopular minority to blame for problems. The president has chosen to blame speculators, aka investors. Anyone who buys a share of a company's stock is speculating about the company's future. For Chrysler's bankruptcy and the dubious legality of his proposal. Yet he simultaneously says he hopes that private investors will begin supplanting government as a source of capital for the companies. Breathes there an investor speculator with such a stunted sense of risk that he or she would go into business with this capricious government?" So spoke George Will. This past week, a letter by hedge fund manager Clifford Asness whipped its way around the net. Asness, while not having an investment in Chrysler, felt compelled to defend his brethren. Asness said that, quote, "The president screaming that the hedge funds are looking for an unjustified taxpayer-funded bailout is the big lie, writ large. Find me a hedge fund that has been bailed out." Asness added, quote, "Here's a shock. When hedge funds, pension funds, mutual funds, and individuals, including very sweet grandmothers, lend their money, they expect to get it back." Wall Street, wrote Asness, is not an owned lackey of the Oval Office to be scolded for disobedience by the president. Close quote. Obama obviously doesn't care about the criticism he's receiving, at least not yet. He knows the vast majority of Americans want to demonize Wall Street for all the nation's ills, and that his stance plays well with much of the segment that put him in office. But while Wall Street does indeed deserve a large share of the blame for coming up with financial products that almost brought down the global financial system, it's quite another thing to ignore the law of the land, the very contract law that is the foundation of any free society. It's kind of funny. Many in Washington have said of China over the past decade that the government there must improve its contract law. But like with so much of America these days, such as in our trade policies, we, i.e. the government, are as hypocritical as any in the world. With his treatment of Chrysler and General Motors bondholders, Obama isn't even walking a fine line. He's trampling some very basic tenets, going back to the Founding Fathers, all for a few votes. That's not exactly change I can believe in. Many of us fair-minded sorts are disappointed. If Obama is the pragmatist he wants us all to believe he is, he'll take a long walk in the woods at Camp David and recognize the errors of his ways. But for some Chrysler and GM investors, it's already too late. Just a few thoughts on H1N1, the virus, as it continues to spread, but the lethality is such most of us have largely ignored it. Henry Miller, a former flu researcher, now at Stanford's Hoover Institution, notes in an op-ed for the New York Post, "What do we know then, 2 weeks after the outbreak? For one thing, we're bedeviled by cost-benefit decisions. Only hindsight will pick the winners and losers, but it appears that U.S. public health officials, especially those at the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health, and also those in New York City, have acted with appropriate judgment and restraint. Federal officials have accumulated, analyzed, and disseminated information, offering advice to the public and to health professionals. They're preparing for a worsening of the situation, but aren't overreacting. They've made testing kits widely available around the country and abroad. Their laboratories are working around the clock, performing sequencing and other analyses of swine flu isolates, and they're preparing contingency plans should the situation change suddenly. Perhaps most important, they aren't making dubious, alarmist pronouncements. The ease of international travel raises the stakes for the prospect of emerging diseases. The swine flu outbreak could serve as a valuable wake-up call, making us think critically about who will be entrusted with public health decisions." That was Henry Miller. The World Health Organization has warned that H1N1 could return, quote, with a vengeance, and that in a true global pandemic, 2 billion of us could become infected. I told you last week that I've certainly added the virus to my risk factors when it comes to investing, and I won't hesitate to pull the trigger on my equity holdings at the first sign of a second wave next fall, should it appear to be more serious than the existing bout. You'd be a fool not to take it seriously. But for now, we can only trust that those in charge are over-preparing, as the WHO's Margaret Chan put it. Some experts, for instance, say we can't discount the possibility the lethal H5N1 bird flu virus combines with H1N1. That would be scary, friends, though it's far from certain this will ever occur. I do have to note, though, that I was at a dinner on Wednesday, and a friend of mine in the hotel business in New York said he couldn't believe the reaction to Vice President Biden's comment that he would advise family members to avoid mass transit at all costs. Rob told me that as soon as Biden spoke, his Marriott received quite a few cancellations. That tells you a lot about the panicky psyches of our fellow Americans, which isn't helped by irresponsible pronouncements on the part of elected officials. Turning to the stock market, stocks rose for the 8th week in 9. 9 in a row for NASDAQ as these stress test results fueled the latest stage of the rally, along with further signs the economy had bottomed. The Dow Jones picked up 4.4% to 85.74, while the S&P 500 gained 5.9% to 9.29. The S&P is now up 37% from the March 9 low. Incredible. NASDAQ, though, underperformed in tacking on another 1.2% as funds rotated out of tech and into cyclical issues that would benefit from a recovery, including energy as well as financials. Some of the individual gains since the March lows have been remarkable. 200, 300, 400%, and then some. We were at the heights of despair back in March, as I wrote, but your editor, me, stayed the course with his bullish forecast that stocks would register 20% plus gains for the year. No doubt we are a long ways off from that prediction and in need of a rest, like a 5 to 7% correction from these levels. We also need some legitimate news that reflects real growth, or the earnings won't come in to warrant some of the valuations we are now seeing. My next podcast will not be until Sunday evening, May 17th. Have a great week.